Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. If you have children or were in school during the first years of the pandemic, you know firsthand the challenges to education and learning. And those hardships from virtual and hybrid classrooms can still be felt today. Flash forward 3 years later, we're still seeing some concrete evidence of what the pandemic cost California students in terms of English and math proficiency. In short, it reversed nearly six straight years of academic improvement. The PPIC, or Public Policy Institute of California, is an independent, nonpartisan think tank and recently reviewed the most recent data on learning loss. The results show that California ranks towards the bottom for math and English. Among the 50 states, including Washington, D.C., California is ranked 38th in math and 33rd in reading. But this data is important to find the right solutions. Joining us to discuss some key findings is Iwunze Ugo, a research fellow at PPIC, the Public Policy Institute of California. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we have heard anecdotally, really since the start of the pandemic, when everything shut down in 2020, you know, the learning loss associated with the pandemic. But now we really are getting some concrete numbers and a clearer picture of that impact. So before we get into the numbers and dive in, tell us about where this data came from and the time frame that it was collected.
Sure. So we're talking about the spring 2022 administration of the Smarter Balance Tests, or the SBAC tests. These are the state standards tests in reading and math. They're administered to students in grades 3 through 8, as well as grade 11. And there was a great deal of interest in these results because they provide the first real look at student scores throughout the pandemic. The tests were canceled in 2020, and the spring 2021 tests were made optional as districts still struggled to reopen, and fewer than 25% of students took those exams. So again, these 2022 scores are really our first look at how students have fared through the years of the pandemic. And also, students took this test again this past spring in 2023. And we're looking forward to those results later this fall to get another look at how that progress is evolving as students continue to emerge from the pandemic.
So those 2022 tests were really like your first real kind of snapshot of the impacts of the pandemic. And that must have been a big deal for someone like you who researches K through 12 education in the state.
Yes, absolutely. It's been an incredible challenge for districts throughout the state managing the pandemic. You know, they were, in a sense, flying blind a lot because, you know, there's all this stuff is happening at the same time and they're trying to sort of keep up with everything that they were facing. And from the outside, as researchers, there's sort of notes here and there, but this is our first real statewide look across a variety of subgroups and, you know, a real comprehensive look at how students are doing.
What was the big message that you got from these 2022 Smarter Balanced assessments?
I think the top line number is that these years of the pandemic were very challenging. Students struggled. We saw, you know, significant setbacks in proficiency rates. And, you know, those were widespread. You know, in every student group that we looked at, we saw those shares of students meeting the state standards in both reading and math declined by quite a bit, math even more so.
Mm. Yeah, you also found when looking back, you know, to what, 2013 to 2019, I believe, that, you know, there was steady progress in academic achievement when it came to English and math proficiency across the state. Can you give us a better understanding of why that progress and that improvement was taking place in the years leading up to the pandemic?
Sure. So California underwent a massive set of reforms to its funding and accountability system with the local control funding formula, as well as the local control accountability plans, the sort of continuous improvement process, and a reform of its state assessment system to the SBACs away from the California Standards Test, or the CST, was part of that reform. There were massive increases in funding. A lot of funding was reformed to target high-need students, low-income and English learner students. And we were seeing some steady progress and improvements from those reforms. There was a bit of a resetting of the levels as we moved away to the new test, but in the years since the first year of administration of that test in 2015, scores had been improving year by year up until, of course, the pandemic, which hit, you know, in the first year after 2019.
Yeah. So you were looking at assessments from 2019 and now you have assessments from 2022. And what the research found was that it reversed 6 years of academic improvement. I mean, how bad of a regression are we talking about?
It's a lot, right? You know, 6 years, you know, that's, you know, from first grade to seventh grade, you know, that's a long time in a student's trajectory. One thing that we looked at, especially when we're talking about growth, is, you know, typically we'll report on proficiency rates. You know, that's the share of students meeting state standards. And sometimes we might even compare that to the rates from previous years. But when we really want to hone in on student growth, on academic progress, we like to follow cohorts of students over time, right, to see how a set of students is progressing through the state school system. And looking over the last 3 years, you know, recent cohorts are of particular interest because, you know, let's say going from grade three to grade six, for example, those recent cohorts, and this is putting it incredibly lightly, have had a very different 3 years compared to
students. Bumpy, to say the least, right?
Yes, exactly. And looking at those results, you know, comparing sort of the progression of growth, which is something that we can do with the SBAC tests, we saw that students in this most recent pandemic-affected cohort had about 70% of the progress over the last 3 years that previous cohorts had over the same stretch of time, right? So you think, you know, 70%, that's a 30% less, a third less progress over 3 years. So yes, you know, we're seeing that these most recent cohorts are about a grade behind where we would expect them to be, you know, if not for the massive disruptions of the pandemic.
You also honed in when it comes to a period of education, students moving from third to sixth grade. Why choose this period?
It's a very important time in a student's trajectory. Lots of research shows that, you know, some of the achievement gaps that are the target of, you know, policies and interventions, you know, a lot of those start very early in a child's life, you know, earlier, sixth grade, third grade, even on to early childhood, preschool, things like that. And so it's important to see how students are doing early on the path, especially with such a disruption in their careers, right? You know, we're going to emerge from the pandemic that's ongoing. But this experience, you know, has set students back, and, you know, catching up is a challenge. And, you know, they're starting from a lower base, and that's something that will be with this set of students for a long time. So it's important to see how that early progress is looking, and it's something that we'll be looking at throughout as we get more and more new results from the next administration of the state tests.
Yeah, catching it early, right? Because they still have a lot of years of K-12 education after sixth grade.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, this is it's a hurdle to jump over, not that, you know, school independent of the pandemic was easy in the first place, right? So these children are facing even more challenges on top of, you know, longstanding challenges that have been not just California students, but students around the nation.
Okay, so when it comes to students across the country, is this a common trend? How does California compare to other states?
Yeah, so when we want to talk about national sort of statewide interstate comparisons, we use the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP, or NAEP. And on those tests, California has sort of consistently lagged behind the national average. But, you know, notably, California is a very large, diverse state. It has high shares of low-income students, multilingual students. So when we compare to other similar large, diverse states, Florida, Texas, New York, we see that California's results are much more similar to those. Admittedly, Florida is far ahead of California, but, you know, very similar to Texas, slightly behind in math, and then better or sort of ahead of New York in reading and math. So difficult in general, but compared to other large states, pretty similar.
Mm. Given how diverse California is, I'm sure when you really honed in and got a front row seat to how it affects individual students or certain demographics, when it comes to students who are non-native English speakers, what did the data show about the impact that hybrid or virtual learning had on their academic achievement?
The results showed that English learners had a difficult time. We saw the sort of continuation of longstanding persistent achievement gaps. I think the rates of students meeting state standards in both reading and math were about 15 percentage points lower for English learner students compared to their peers. And we also saw similar results for other high-need student groups, low-income students, Black and Latino students, all had pretty consistent large achievement gaps that existed sort of before and continued on during the pandemic. One interesting point, though, is that the actual size of the declines were slightly smaller for these high-need groups, although, you know, these are, you know, the differences are minimal. They're essentially tied. You know, statistically, they're the same. But, you know, the fact that these results weren't much worse for these high-need student groups is, I think, suggestive that the massive investments from the federal and state government of funds, a lot of which were targeted to these high-need student groups, may have been effective in mitigating some of perhaps the worst potential effects of, you know, a massive disruption like this.
Hmm. Well, are there differences also when you looked at or compared rural school districts compared to urban areas in California and bigger cities?
Yes. Rural districts had a tough time as well. Their rates of proficiency were about 5 percentage points lower in both reading and math. And although rural school districts reopened earlier than urban school districts, you know, their early experience with the pandemic was much more difficult because we see that in these areas there are much higher rates of a lack of access to the kinds of technologies, you know, high-speed internet devices, things like that, that are needed for virtual learning.
Were there any students that either stayed consistent with the assessments that were taken in 2019 or actually fared better, you know, when looking at tests in from 2022?
Unfortunately, this pandemic was, a substantial challenge for the entire state. You know, in all the subgroups that we looked at, and this is across income, race, gender, English language fluency, every subgroup saw their rates of proficiency decline between 2019 and 2022. It's really a matter of which groups had smaller declines versus others, but unfortunately, no, at least the total subgroup, you know, came out of the pandemic better than they went in.
Mm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Iwunze Ugo, Research Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, about new research that's giving us a clearer picture of learning loss during the COVID-19 pandemic in California. You mentioned state as well as federal funding, you know, policymakers, you know, stepping up to the plate during the pandemic. Has it been effective or is there room for improvement?
So going back to March 2020, the onset of the pandemic, federal and state policymakers intervened with massive amounts of funding for the state's schools, both in California and around the nation. Funding for California alone totaled over $28 billion. A lot of those programs were general purpose. Some were designated to particular objectives. There was a variety of different funding streams. One district leader reported that the sort of interacting, overlapping streams of funding could sometimes feel like a plandemic. But even though, you know, making sure that the coherence between all these different funding streams in terms of the interventions and outputs that districts provided was a challenge, this funding was crucial to keep districts afloat and to support the state students.
Given that there obviously needs to be more progress to catch up what was lost during the pandemic when it comes to learning, a lot of that funding was one-time use funding. It's not sustainable. Is that a concern for you as districts are now tasked with helping students catch up, you know, a grade?
Yeah, that's the sort of new additional challenge that is in the air for districts now. We're still working on emerging from the pandemic, but a big focus now is as these emergency funds start to wrap up, one of the major funds, ESSER, is scheduled to sort of lapse at the end of September 2024. They only have a year left to spend a lot of these, you know, massive funding streams. And so a big focus for districts is going to be how to identify and maintain the programs that have been most effective in this challenge of learning recovery. It's going to be very important for districts, and most of them already are, to, you know, seriously consider their data collection efforts and their community engagement in order to identify those programs that are most effective.
Mm. You talked about smarter balance assessments, and that was used to see, you know, what progress or a regression took place for students across the state. Are smarter balance assessments the best measure of a student's success?
There's a lot that goes into student success. Of course, knowing that how well students are doing on reading and math is important, incredibly crucial. But, you know, there's a state test in science, social studies and civics are important. And even beyond that, more summative measures like readiness for college and career, graduation rates are particularly important. Arts and athletics are a particular area that have been really set back by the inability of students to be together. Those took a hit. And then even more broadly, socio-emotional learning and student engagement have been increasingly more important for on the minds of district policymakers. You know, making schools a place where students can feel welcome is increasingly important, and it's been the focus of a lot more attention. And that has been particularly important in the current context because a lot of districts are struggling with dramatically heightened rates of chronic absenteeism.
Yeah. I mean, mental health is a big component of it as well, not just for children, but I think for a lot of people over the last 3 years. Finally, if you're a parent or you're a teacher or a staff member at a K through 12 school, you're listening to this, you're taking in the data that you laid out, what do you hope they take away from this research and conversation?
I think the main takeaway is that we students in California have gone through a lot. I mean, the entire state has gone through a lot. It's been a very traumatic time. And we didn't know the extent of those effects, at least in terms of student achievement on, you know, the state tests. So now we have a bit more information on, you know, how deep the depths are, I guess. And now the focus is, given that, what do we do to continue to make progress in terms of learning recovery? You know, are we going to maintain programs that have been particularly effective? Are we going to seek new funding streams to support those programs and the teachers that administer them? And focusing on how students continue to emerge is going to be the next thing. So we're looking forward to the next test results, to innovative policies that districts are employing to get students back on track, not just to where they were before the pandemic, but to address the challenges that have existed for long before then. And also, you know, not just in test scores, but in the entire educational experience for the state's school children.
Are there still outlier big questions that you want answered as a researcher?
Of course. It's great to have, you know, these statewide results, but, you know, California has 1,000 different districts, 10,000 different schools, and, you know, principals and teachers. You know, it's an army out there, right? And, you know, this has been a very trying time. Districts have been forced to be very innovative because of the urgency of the pandemic. And, you know, there have been some success stories there, right? So as we have more experience with sort of the variety of how things have gone throughout the state, I think really identifying and pulling out the practices and programs that have turned out to be really effective is going to be key, because, you know, we want to see, it's great to see those successes. And after identifying them, you know, the hope is that they can be spread throughout the state so that all the state's children can be exposed to those really effective programs.
Iwunze, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
Iwunze Ugo is a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Autism in American children has been steadily touching more lives. According to the CDC, the rates of autism spectrum disorder have been on the rise for more than two decades, impacting one in 44 children. Experts say the rise is largely due to better screening and awareness, but the increase is prompting scientists to find clues about what causes this disorder, which impacts millions of Americans. One of the challenges facing doctors and scientists is diagnosing it in childhood. While autism can be detected in children as young as 18 months, many children don't receive a confirmed diagnosis until they're adolescents or, in some cases, adults. But a researcher at UC Davis is turning a temporary organ during pregnancy, which is often discarded as medical waste in hospitals, the placenta. Dr. Janine LaSalle is a professor of microbiology and immunology at UC Davis Health and is joining us ahead of her talk at the Davis Science Cafe later this evening at G Street Wonder Bar about how the placenta could help us better understand neurodevelopment and causes of autism. And Dr. LaSalle is joined by one of her grad students, Julia Mowat. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
So Dr. LaSalle, I want to start with you. You've described the placenta as an often misunderstood and an overlooked organ despite its importance. Why do you believe this?
Yeah, I think placenta is probably the one tissue that comes out of the human body that doesn't get sent to the pathology lab. It's, you know, if anybody's given birth in a hospital, they know it goes in a bucket. It's called the afterbirth. It's an afterthought. But we've decided to look at, we're fortunate to collaborate with folks who were collecting these from a high-risk autism cohort. And I've found that it really is like a time capsule of what the baby was exposed to in utero. And again, it's a combination of both genes and environment. And by looking at the DNA from the placenta, the layers on top of that DNA can give us information about the combination of genes and environment.
Mm. Can you just explain for some of us who, you know, aren't aware of just how vital this temporary organ is, the role, which is critical, in an infant's development in the womb?
Yes. So the placenta is this temporary tissue, but its job is to actually bring in blood, which supplies nutrients and oxygen to the developing baby. And again, the brain is probably the most critical part, especially in primates, and humans are primates, because we have such a large brain. The brain is the biggest energy hog. It's the biggest nutrient hog. So you need all that energy and oxygen getting to the fetal brain. And so the placenta, that's what it does. It reaches out and grabs those blood vessels and brings in oxygen to the baby and all the maternal supply. So if something goes wrong with that process, and there can be very subtle things that go wrong, that really can impact the brain. And it may not be evident by things like ultrasounds and other screens.
Why do you think it's taken this long? I mean, we all relied on a placenta, right? You know, I mean, giving birth and pregnancy and labor and all of that has existed, you know, as long as we've been around. Why do you think it's taken so long to understand this organ?
That's a great question. I potentially the hospital births, and you know, historically obstetricians have been male dominated. So maybe more recently, there's a greater appreciation that it's not actually just a woman's tissue. It actually is derived from the fetus. We can find Y chromosome in for male babies. So I don't know why, but again, it's one of those sort of historical things that could have had to do with maybe the lack of diversity in the obstetric practice.
Yeah, and you're part of changing that, as well as you, Julia. So you're a graduate student in Dr. LaSalle's lab. What inspired you to pursue a career in this field?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was really interested in women's health and pregnancy, but also in then for the baby, what are the impacts? And I think autism spectrum disorders are a really interesting thing to study because, as you said, it can be diagnosed sometimes quite young, but we know that what happens in the womb really influences whether a child will develop autism spectrum disorder. And so I think studying that really critical time period is important. And it's because the placenta has been so understudied, there's sort of a ton of research that needs to be done. So it's a really exciting field that's sort of breaking out.
Hmm. Well, Dr. LaSalle, what are you learning about what the placenta can provide in terms of better understanding the causes and the risks of autism?
Yeah, we recently published a study where we, again, it was what I call a lesson in patience, because we had to collect enough these placenta samples. And in this high-risk cohort, it was about 22% of those children had autism. So it's better than the general population, which is about a little under 2% now. But we had to wait until we had enough samples from placentas of babies that went on to develop autism. But from that, we got, you know, a really nice what we call a hit, a eureka moment on a single chromosome, and discovered a new gene that we're now following up on. We got to name the gene and are now understanding what it does. But it seems to be something that is actually increased with hypoxia or lack of oxygen, which again, as I mentioned, the placenta has to bring in the oxygen to the baby. So this is a gene where there's genetic differences in the population, and then we can tell the babies that are higher risk for autism from this locus.
And that research was published in February, correct? Earlier this year?
It was a year ago, yeah.
Oh, a year ago. Julia, how did this help you? You better understand, you know, the scientific potential of what the placenta and other, you know, really vital tissues like the umbilical cord, you know, what it could provide in better understanding neurodevelopmental disorders.
Yeah, I think, as Janine said, it was such a eureka finding. And so I think it is really showing how helpful tissues like placenta can really be. And again, just bringing us back to that, there hasn't been as much research in placenta and those types of tissues, but I think this can really help us. And we're now diving more into this new gene and trying to understand what it can do. And this could just really help diagnose autism earlier in younger kids, which would just be really helpful for the community.
You know, given that if someone is pregnant, they can, you know, get blood work done to see if they are at risk for some disorders. I mean, is that the case for autism as well? Does that currently not exist? And could this research potentially help give people a better understanding or a better idea if they are at a higher risk of having a child that can have autism later?
Yeah, I think right now we're not at the stage where we can diagnose, but if we can even identify the risk, the children at higher risk, I think everyone could benefit from some of the behavioral interventions that they currently do with kids. And again, the earlier you could start, the better. So if we could identify sort of the kids that are at higher risk, particularly if they are sort of younger siblings from families that already have autism, which we know also are already at higher risk, if we can identify those and get them into, you know, some intervention or even just watching. There's a lot of medical issues that come up also in some cases of autism, like gastrointestinal problems, seizures that can come out in later childhood and things like that that could be addressed.
Someone might be listening to this and wondering, is there anything I can do if I become pregnant to help prevent this or to help mitigate these risks? I mean, did you get any answers with that eureka discovery?
Yes, absolutely. And I really would like to say this because taking prenatal vitamins in the first month of pregnancy. So again, this is a bit challenging because if you're planning a pregnancy, please take prenatal vitamins. They not only prevent neural tube defects, but they also prevent autism. And we saw this in our gene locus because, you know, there, some individuals were at the higher genetic risk, but they didn't have autism, but they were mothers that had taken the prenatal vitamin in the first month of pregnancy. So that's the one preventative thing we know that you can do. And unfortunately, if it's probably too late by the time of the first prenatal visit. It's still good to take it, but the prevention of both neural tube defects and autism is really right in that first month of pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we've been speaking with Professor Janine LaSalle at UC Davis and UC Davis grad student Julia Mowat about how the placenta could help detect autism and other disorders in infants. So Julia, I mean, it's not just the placenta, right? Are there other samples that are collected at birth that could be useful in autism research?
Yeah, and we are using those tissues. The main one is newborn blood. So in California and some other states, newborns have their heels pricked, and then researchers can get those samples, and then we can do investigations because we're able to get the DNA from those samples. And so in California, those have been collected. It started in the 80s, and so now we're building up quite a large database of those samples that we are able to use in conjunction with placenta. And so that's also sort of a new burgeoning field.
You're also looking into how placental tissues can help us understand how maybe the lives of our parents or our grandparents or previous generations can impact our health, which includes, if neurodevelopment as well.
Yeah, and this is super exciting and something I'm really interested in. So we know that in epidemiological studies, we have seen that certain aspects of our parents or grandparents, including their health or their behavior, can potentially increase risk for autism in the children or grandchildren, but we don't really know why or how that could be working. And so we're starting to be able to use these samples, the placenta and the newborn blood, to be able to understand if across generations, our health and our behavior can influence risk for autism. Things such as cigarette smoking is one thing that we're looking into. And because California started collecting these newborn blood spots back in the 80s, you know, we're starting to get to the point where we can have two, even potentially three generations of those blood spots and be able to look multiple generations what is going on in the DNA.
Yeah, you're talking about, you know, something that is genetic, but there's also environmental factors, right, Dr. LaSalle, that can contribute to an increased risk for autism.
Yes, and that's actually why we focus on the placenta too, is because all of these environmental factors really focus around in utero exposures. And there are the ones that are common in the population where they can do really big numbers in epidemiology, and that would be like air pollution and pesticides. So those are ones where there have been, you know, mixed studies, but definitely I think air pollution is probably one of the stronger ones. But then there are some of the, you know, more rare exposures. Actually, rubella infection during pregnancy, you know, is rare in the population. But my concern is actually with some of the next generation who, maybe whose parents were trying to prevent autism in the child by not getting their vaccinations, with those, you know, women grow up and have children of their own. If they get rubella during pregnancy, that could be really, it's like a 50-fold increased risk for autism in the child.
You know, given that we're not at a point yet of diagnosing autism in utero, you know, we're still learning a lot about autism. Someone may think, okay, well, if it can't be reversed in someone, if they have autism, they're going to have autism. What are the benefits to getting ahead of it and learning of this diagnosis at 18 months versus when they're adolescents or even in some cases an adult?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're definitely not too trying to prevent, you know, autism. It's something you're born with. It's you know, there's a large part that's genetic. But what you can do is with early interventions is just understand. Yeah, again, the behavioral interventions can often help kids become high functioning. They're not really changing the personality. It's improving their ability to adapt. But also the medical issues that can arise because you know, there are issues with sleep. Again, with GI, constipation, diarrhea, and things like that, that actually can almost, if those aren't addressed, that it could make things much worse. Because again, the brain is dependent on everything else in our body, and getting the children getting enough sleep and addressing GI issues before they become a problem is really important.
And autism was first like officially kind of discovered or diagnosed in like 1980, correct? So it's been a few, I don't know, yeah, over 40 years, you know, of work and research and awareness. And now, I mean, the CDC recently, I believe back in this last spring in March, they released a report stating that they found autism rates have increased in the U.S., but that's also largely due to that awareness, right? And that screening and that testing. Does that just increase your sense of urgency to better understand the root causes and risks?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I've been working in this area for over 20 years now, and I think about the time that the Mind Institute started at UC Davis, I got interested in these sort of unknown forms of autism. And yes, the challenge for the field is that over that time, the diagnosis has changed. Every time they come out with a new DSM, it changes. So it is a challenge for the field because the diagnosis of autism is changing. But I think it's more motivation to come up with molecular tests, and that's what we're doing, is if you could have a laboratory test, not a behavioral diagnosis, that would make it easier to, again, identify kids at risk for developing those behaviors later on.
Well, remind us what the Mind Institute is.
Yeah, the Mind Institute is a center at UC Davis that really focuses on neurodevelopmental disorders, particularly autism. And it was started by a push from parents of kids with autism back in the 90s, who really said they wanted to have a research center to focus on this area, and they wanted it in Sacramento, being close to the policymakers in Sacramento.
And Julia, I mean, you're part of the next generation of scientists in this field. It must be an exciting time for you as well.
Yeah, it is really exciting. And I think that connection with the Mind Institute, being in Sacramento near policymakers, I'm really interested in science policy and science communication. And so I think this is a really exciting field to be in. Mm.
And Dr. LaSalle, this is kind of like a preview conversation because you're going to be talking tonight at the Davis Science Cafe. And it's titled The Womb's Wisdom, Predictive Insights from the Delivery Room Trash Bin. And the event is at 5:30 p.m. at G Street Wonder Bar in downtown Davis. If people are going to be attending this evening, what can they expect from tonight's discussion?
A lot of audience participation about their feelings about this field, and I will be talking about autism, but I wanted to kind of start with the womb because I think the womb has a nice connotation to it.
Yeah. And it touches a lot of people's lives. I think in a venue like the Davis Science Cafe, you know, at a bar in downtown Davis, it must be nice to change the environment from an academia setting to just the general public and people who are just interested in learning more.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited about this. It's a different thing for me. It's, you know, but I really do like, and I think like students have almost pushed me more into the science communication, and I've been working on that as well, because I think it's important, you know, that we do step away from the from our own little bubble sometimes and explain to people why we're doing what we do.
Julia, what do you hope people take away from the conversation if they attend tonight?
I think just to think more about the placenta. I think we don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. I surely never did before joining Janine's lab, but I think it's a great organ, and I think we should all not be scared to talk more about the placenta.
Yep, and the womb's wisdom.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. LaSalle and Julia, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you.
And all the research. Dr. Janine LaSalle is a professor of microbiology and immunology at UC Davis Health, along with graduate student Julia Mowat, sharing their research into the placenta and its potential to help us better understand the causes of autism. Dr. LaSalle will be hosting a conversation on this topic this evening at the Davis Science Cafe. That is at the G Street Wonder Bar in Davis, and it starts at 5:30 p.m. Still ahead, a comic herstorian, H-E-R, is coming to Sacramento. Trina Robbins is the first female to draw Wonder Woman for DC Comics and joins us ahead of her Sacramento visit to talk about her pioneering career. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Inside on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Fandom for comic books transcends generations. From Iron Man to Batman, Superman, and Spider-Man, the list goes on and on and on. And many of these superheroes come with a common theme, a name ending with man. Of course, there are iconic female comic book characters like Wonder Woman, Storm, and Catwoman, but even the creation of these heroes often was shaped by a male imagination. But Trina Robbins carved her own path. With a career that spans more than 60 years, Trina has cemented herself as a pioneer in the comic book world. The first female to draw Wonder Woman for DC Comics, in addition to a very long list of other groundbreaking illustrations and designs. The comic herstorian, H-E-R, is still busy today, joining us ahead of a Sacramento visit to inspire the imagination of future illustrators. Trina, welcome. What a treat.
Hi, Vicki. Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start from the very beginning. When did you first become interested and really kind of dip into drawing comics?
You know, as a kid, my mother taught me to read. She was a second grade school teacher. So I just dove into reading. And along with reading books, I was reading comics. I was reading anything I could get my hands on, my little tiny child hands. And I was also drawing. I've always been drawing. So it just came together.
What was it about comic books that gave you really an inspiration that was a springboard for such a successful career?
Visuals. You know, they say that one word is worth a thousand. How does that go?
One picture is worth a thousand words.
That's it. So then add the words. Add the words, and it's worth even more. You know, the combination of pictures and words is the ultimate way of communication.
And it might be easy to take for granted everything that you accomplished during a time that was overwhelmingly dominated by men. Can you just take us back to that time and how you really navigated and carved your own way?
Well, I had to carve my own way because I wasn't invited into the boys' club. You know, they were putting out comics. And we're talking now about when I started, I was doing underground comics. These were not Spider-Man and Superman and Wonder Woman. But the underground comics also had a boys' club. And they would publish their own books. They would put together their own books and have them published, but they never invited me into their books, and they never invited me to their get-togethers and their parties. I was alone. So, you know, I just said, the hell with this, I'll do it myself, and I did it myself.
That is wonderful, you know, but that takes a lot of drive and determination. What kept you persevering, given that, you know, it wasn't only that you weren't invited, but I think in many places the door was shut. So you had to create your own room.
Shut. Yes, and I did. I built my own room. What provoked it? Anger. Anger. It's like, you want to keep me out? I got news for you. You won't keep me out. And the thing is, I was good. I mean, the publishers, I had no problem with the publishers. They just wanted to sell books. And they saw that my comics sold. So they were fine with publishing me. It was just the guys.
Yeah, I mean, it had been the guys drawing Wonder Woman for decades. How did drawing Wonder Woman come about for you?
Amazingly enough, I was invited. DC Comics phoned me and asked me if I would like to do a four-part Wonder Woman. And I said, yeah.
And the rest is history. Herstory, exactly. Yeah, that is an important point. When people watch or see your drawing, your illustration of Wonder Woman, what will they see, even if it's nuanced, that might be different than previous illustrations of Wonder Woman?
Well, actually, when I did my Wonder Woman, and we're talking about the 80s, this was a long time ago, but it had been 40 years of just guys drawing her, you know. But when I did my Wonder Woman, I wanted to hearken back to the original Wonder Woman. And, you know, that's, to me, that is the true Wonder Woman, the original Wonder Woman as drawn by Harry Peter, who created her, really, along with William Moulton Marston. You know, you have to have the writing and the drawing, remember. Marston wrote it. Harry Peter drew it. So I wanted to do that one. And I did. I did it in Harry Peter's style. I had a big pile of Golden Age Wonder Woman comics next to me while I was drawing it. And I would look at them all the time. You know, how did Harry Peter do this? How did he do that? You know, how did he draw Wonder Woman leaping? You know, things like that.
Yeah, looking at today, what do you make of mainstream comics and how it's really catapulted into action movies and these huge Comic-Con conventions, which you have been a part of? I mean, there's even a Wonder Woman franchise now, obviously.
Oh, of course there is. The fact is, I'm not into superheroes. I mean, Wonder Woman is probably the exception. I don't like the whole concept of superheroes is that if something is wrong, you fight, you know? It's like, I don't believe in that. I don't believe in fighting. If something is wrong, you talk it out, discuss it, you know? Not immediately with the fist.
What comic books would you recommend someone dip into if they haven't really enjoyed comic books before then?
Graphic novels. Forget about those floppy comics, you know, with the guys punching each other out. Graphic novels, which are so varied, and they're so meaty, there's so much more to a graphic novel than to this little crummy 20-page comic.
And you not only were the first woman to draw Wonder Woman, but you also crafted the first comic with an out lesbian as a protagonist. You have edited the first all-female comic book. Are you satisfied with the strides that are being made currently within the comic book industry? You know, characters that are women, of course, but also from the LGBTQ+ community, pretty much from a larger variety of walks of life.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Never in my wildest dreams what I have imagined, that there would come a day when so many women would be drawing comics, and also men who don't want to do superheroes, telling real stories, you know? I never dreamed this would happen. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about, you know, your other creativity and success in talent and designs. It includes like a pretty iconic rock era. Did you design costumes for Jim Morrison?
Not costumes. And I never did make anything for Jim, but I did make a pair of red velvet bell bottoms for his girlfriend. I made a lot of clothes for the girlfriends and wives of the rock and rollers.
How do you reflect on that era? It sounds pretty cool to me.
It was great. It was a great time. I had a boutique and I was making clothes, and the clothes were terrific.
Yep. And now they're part of history as well. You know, you mentioned, you know, instead of saying history or historian, you say her story or historian. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
It means it's a woman's history, you know, because one thing that I have discovered in all of my research and all of my writing is that if you're not written about, you're forgotten. And men tend to write about men. It's really, when I went to college, there was an art book that was, every college had this art book, and there was not one woman in the art book.
Wow. And you're now part of changing that. I mean, you continue to write to this day. You don't really take many breaks. You're writing about women who drew comics in the early 20th century, correct?
Yes. Yes. Because they weren't written about. Because when guys write comics histories, they just want to talk about Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and the Hulk. They're not interested in the fact that there were all these women in the early 20th century. All these women drawing comics, and they were great. They were wonderful, you know? And before I started writing my books, the guys would simply say, oh, women didn't draw comics. But that's not true, you know? Not only did they draw comics, but they were incredible. They were superstars.
What goes into all the research behind writing about women who drew comics that could, you know, very potentially have been forgotten about in history?
They have been forgotten about until I wrote about them.
How were you able to accomplish that? I mean, there's a lot of research and work, you know, on, you know, when you look behind the curtains to actually make that a reality into a book.
You know, research is so much fun. The whole point of doing these books is so that I can research these women. And the stuff I find out is so cool. Some of these women had amazing lives. Gladys Parker, my Gladys Parker book, which came out last year, has been nominated for an Eisner at the San Diego Comic Convention. And the Eisner is basically the Oscar of the comics world. Well, she was so cool. Number one, she looked exactly like the heroine she drew, Mopsy. She was adorable. She was so cute, you just about can't stand it. And she just made her own publicity because she was so cool. She pioneered pants in the 1930s, when maybe a couple of movie stars like Katharine Hepburn could get away with wearing pants, but most women simply didn't. And she wore pants, and she designed pants. She not only drew comics, but she was a fashion designer. She made clothes for movie stars.
That was pretty similar to you as well. You know, you designed as
in addition to illustrations. Not quite as fantastic as her.
You know, finally, Trina, you're going to be making a visit to Sacramento this weekend. You're going to be speaking with some local Girl Scouts. You know, what advice do you hope to impart on, you know, these younger generations who might want to break into a field that is still, you know, dominated by people that don't really look like them?
Well, you know, draw comics. And once you're good enough, start by self-publishing your own comics. Produce zines, give them away, trade them. And soon people will see your work. You know, you have to be seen. You have to be seen. And then people will write about you.
Trina, thank you so much for making the time. It really was a treat.
Thank you.
Trina Robbins is a pioneer in the comic book world, the first female to draw Wonder Woman for DC Comics, in addition to a very long list of other groundbreaking illustrations and designs. And with that, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minana. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Mark Jones today as well. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.